So people ask me a lot about the success of the school and the achievements and the innovative practices and the types of things that our students are doing and how they're making a dent in local and global community. And I really say the secret sauce is around the norms.
And so welcome back, everyone, to the Modern Learners Podcast, episode number 20 already. Who believes that? That voice that you heard was that of Brett Jacobson, who's the headmaster of the Mount Vernon Presbyterian School outside of Atlanta, which is where I happen to be right now, not at MVP, but outside of Atlanta. And that was from an interview that we did with Brett about 3 years ago that we are recycling and putting out again. Because Bruce Dixon, my friend in Melbourne, Australia, and I are on a little bit of a podcast vacation, just 1 week. We figured 20 episodes is time to take a little bit of a break. So I know you're going to enjoy this conversation with Brett. He is at one of the most interesting, innovative schools that's out there right now, doing a whole bunch of work around design thinking, around inquiry-based learning, and all sorts of other good stuff. And those norms that he refers to in that little snip that I gave you at the top are powerful, powerful motivators and guides to the learning that happens at Mount Vernon. And I just know you're going to enjoy listening to this conversation as I did, listening to it again a few years after the fact. Don't forget, we're not on vacation at our Modern Learners Change Leaders group on Facebook, and you can also find us at modernlearners.com and change.school and all sorts of other places online, and we would love to have you interact and give us some feedback or questions on this particular podcast by going to our podcast page at modernlearners.com and using our SpeakPipe app. You can leave us a question or just give a comment on what you're hearing. But for now, let's get right to this conversation with Brett Jacobson from Mount Vernon Presbyterian. Enjoy it, everyone. Let's just start with maybe a bit of an overview on Mount Vernon Presbyterian. And I'm interested in what's, because I know a little bit about the school, and I know that you're doing some innovative things there, but I'm interested in what's typical about your school, but also then what's unique about it.
I think the typical part of it as an independent school is, you know, it's a preschool through 12, you know, community, and, you know, at the heartbeat of a community are students and teachers and parents, and that strong relationship that those relationships that are developed and that community feel. I think that's, you know, fairly, you know, typical about the school. That's reflective of other schools and other independent schools in particular, but both in public and private sector. I think what's unique about the school, Steve Jobs, you know, has a particular quote about that I've recently quoted to our faculty about sometimes it's easier to connect the dots looking backwards than looking forward. And part of the dots connecting of looking backwards is really having a revised mission statement that was intentional and directional, purposeful. And, you know, the first sentence is, we are a school of inquiry, innovation, and impact. Done. I mean, that's it. And I think that that's a unique mission statement that's out there amongst schools, as well as, you know, I would even say, you know, from a corporate or other nonprofit, civic, you know, communities that's out there. But I also think that part of the secret sauce of the school that makes it unique is really around the posture, the culture. And so, you know, we've developed what we've called the Mount Vernon norms, and it's about starting with questions, failing up, sharing the well, assuming the best, meaning about relationships, because, you know, we have parents, students, and teachers, and all unique in expectation and needs, and how can we assume the best about each other? And then having fun. Have fun is rounding out that norm. And so people ask me a lot about the success of the school and the achievements and the innovative practices and the types of things that our students are doing and how they're making a dent in local and global community. And I really say the secret sauce is around the norms more mm-hmm. than anything, because these norms reflect, they're directly aligned with our mission.
Yeah. And I think I've told you this in the past, but I trot your mission out almost everywhere I go. I think it's, I do. I think, yeah, I think it's pretty brilliant in that it's very clear. It's very direct. And I don't know how you could be confused about what is supposed to be happening in classrooms in a school where, whose mission is inquiry, impact, and innovation. And so tell me a little bit about how you came to that vision. What was the process that you used? And was it a difficult job getting to that, just tell me a little bit about how that happened?
Sure. Well, briefly, this is my sixth year starting at the school, and so, you know, when I came, you know, 5 years ago to the school, I was really looking for an organization that I could connect, you know, with, and I have two young children, and obviously wanting them to grow up in an environment that I thought would be great for them, but also I was really looking for an agile organization because, as we know, we're living in such a transformative period around the world. You know, who is going to be flexible and agile enough to transform? And when you have a lot of inertia within any organization, so I say this about, you know, we could say this about GE or any other company exist. This is not relegated to, you know, to schools. Who is going to be able to pivot because it's best for kids? And so I think I've really found that here. And so from that, we began to have a lot of many conversations, and there have been many influencers, I would say, along the way. You know, one has been, like most people, and when Thomas Friedman came out with World is Flat, but then also, you know, I continue to talk about, you know, Dan Pink's A Whole New Mind. Do you hear people continuing to talk about it? I don't. And I think because that was a book du jour of the day, that people just have moved on past that. But we're continuing to thread that through. It's an important piece, and it was influential. Another influencer, you know, was Global Achievement Gap. Again, it was a popular book at the time. I don't hear people continuing to talk about it, but we are, because if we found it to be important several years ago about the strategic vision of the school, then I think we should continue to talk about it today. I mean, even Good to Great as an influencer about disciplined people, it's all about the who, the discipline thought and discipline action. I mean, those have been influencers about what we're doing. And so when you're just taking a look well beyond the life of a school and seeing what's happening in the world, you know, I think that begins to bring up some questions for you in any organization, and especially a school, about how are you positioning your students for the future by providing them experiences now. I mean, I heard an executive here in Atlanta say, you know, my son is getting his MBA and he's 28, and that's all great and fine, but why is he back-ending his learning process? You know, the flow of learning, you know, at the beginning of what he's doing when he was younger. And so, and then we could look at, you know, engagement and motivation of students, that it's high when you're in preschool and lower school, but then it is lower in middle and lower in upper, because we've sucked the life out of them. It's so prescribed, it's so cookie cutter, and it's all about just textbooks, and it's about school. It's not about learning. And so, you know, we've really begun to disrupt this idea of the difference between learning and school, and really try to talk about we need to look at what the differences are and what's most important. And so we've really begun to ask the question leading into this year is, what is most essential? Greg McCown, go ahead.
When you say we, who's in that conversation? Is it parents? Yes. Is it students? I mean, I'm assuming it's all those, right?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Let me go back to even Global Achievement Gap. So we landed on what we call the Mount Vernon mind, these six mindsets that we really want our students to embody and develop and evolve and become as they leave us. And that's built around, you know, collaboration and communication and being a solution seeker, innovator, communicator, et cetera. And so that, for example, was a process that we had this this collaborative effort of all preschool through 12 faculty members. And on the side, I was working with a committee of representatives of the school who are working alongside the mass of every teacher and staff member at the school. And so we began to iterate on what this looked like that would be appropriate for and applicable for our school. And by the end of the year, we were able to go through another iteration of it. And so by the time they came back in August, we began to, at minimum, just from a common language standpoint, we began to place this poster in every classroom. Mm-hmm. It doesn't end with that poster, but it was a launching point of common language. And I have to, one thing I talk a lot about when I'm asked questions about the school, I wish I'd have known this in advance. I stumbled into it in terms of the success of how impactful this is. And Susie Boss talks about this in her book, Bringing Innovation into School. But having common language, mm-hmm. I wish I'd have known that on the front end, mm-hmm. because I would have been even more intentional than even how intentional we have been. But common language in collaborating on that common language and what it means is so important. And so we even did a reboarding and an onboarding process for our norms, because I can't assume that everybody knows what fell up means. And in talking mm-hmm. to the students, saying you are adding as much to the conversation on what fell up means or share the well than we do as adults. We all collectively are adding to this conversation of really defining what it means and how this looks at our school. So that's an example of, or two examples of how we're trying to incorporate, you know, every aspect of our school. But I'm also a believer that at the end of the day, like Good to Great talks about, is that there has to be an executive who's going to make a decision. And you have to be decisive about that decision, and yet embracing the fact that that decision is still going to evolve over time. But you can't. So the first 2 years that I was here, we talked a lot about 21st century skills, and the eyes would glaze over, which is understandable because people got tired of talking about that. But I began to ask, or I kept hearing, well, which ones? Haven't we always been doing that as teachers?
Right.
And so when you hear those questions, you know, one, does everybody understand what this is about and why this is important? And yet, let's land the plane and develop some common language, and then begin able to take some risk and ooch this innovation and test it and allow it to iterate. But until we can land the plane, we're just going to be circling and never executing on what we're doing at the school, because our students are the most important component of what we do.
Yeah, and I know Chris Lehman at Science Leadership Academy talks about common language a lot as well, and most of the places that I go that seem to have this culture around innovation and learning, or kind of rethinking learning, they're all on the same page. They at least know what they mean when they say certain things. Like, I'm interested in your definition, you used it before. I'm interested, what's your definition of transformation, for instance? I mean, when you talk about transformation in your school, what does that mean?
Again, I'll sort of go back to the norms a little bit, because transformation is the ability for any organization to start with questions, that they're curious, they're inquisitive, they're asking questions, and it's not always built around how it has been done. I don't really like to use the term best practice, because to me, it's like saying master teacher. I don't know if we shouldn't master anything, because transformation is always about learning and growing and developing. Transformation is about thinking differently.
So it sounds like for you, which is a little bit different from the way I hear other people talking about it, that transformation is not a destination as much as it is a process, right?
Correct.
Right. Yep. And so a lot of people say, well, we've transformed our school because now everyone has an iPad. That's not what it is, right? It is about questions. And it is, you know, another thing that I found interesting, and I was reading a piece that you wrote for an interview that you did for your school magazine, I think it was earlier this year, where you were talking about the DNA of Mount Vernon Presbyterian. And you used a couple words and terms that I thought were really interesting that I don't think I've heard in any other education conversation from leadership, at least, that you look at yourselves as disruptors and that you're biased. I love this phrase, you're biased towards shipping ideas. Could you talk a little bit about those two things too? Because I find those to be pretty unique.
Yes. And I think that really comes from what our mission requires of us. So 2 years ago, I gave a faculty address and I really began to say, you know, we have this ambitious mission that it's not aspirational, but this is achievable, but it requires something of us. So let's take a look at what this mission requires of us. And if you're going to say you're going to be a school of innovation, or you're going to say you're a school preparing students to be globally competitive, what does that require of me as the head of school? What does that require of you as a teacher in the classroom? I mean, that's a tall order, and there's a lot, you know, around that. And so part of it is to say that we're going to ship an idea, you know, and this concept comes from, you know, Seth Godin's work, and to say that, you know, independent schools in particular, we are notorious for wanting to ship a perfectly packaged product. And then we unveil it. I mean, you know, as we're speaking, you know, Apple has unveiled their, you know, latest iPhone. I don't think it was the greatest unveiling Apple's ever had, but nonetheless, you know, the company continues to evolve, and there's an iteration of just that one example of an iPhone that they're shipping an idea, and then they're working it out. They're iterating it, and it's not going to be perfect. And you just ship and ship again. And so creating a culture where it's safe to make a mistake. So 2 years ago, I said, at the end of the year, you know, we always give out a Servant Leader of the Year award, and we give out an Innovator of the Year award. We're going to add one more, and only one more award to this, and it's going to be a Mistake of the Year award. And we are going to give this out. And this is not about, you know, what people would define as just traditional mistakes. This is defined about you are going to take a risk, and and it's about trying something new. And we want to honor that and recognize that here at Mount Vernon. So creating a culture where it is okay to take a risk, that's a part of the shipping ideas that's important. And I think at times that's disruptive to how schools always operate. And I think if you look at innovation in particular, I think you can look at it at three levels. One is that we're going to, you know, kind of tweak something that we're doing as a way to transform and as a way to innovate, or we're going to actually adopt a new way of doing something. I think that's another tier of innovation. And then a third tier would be, what if our industry didn't exist? What if our product, you know, what would we do?
Right, starting all over again.
Yeah. And so I think that that disruption part of that quote from that interview relates to the fact that there's tweaking, there's adapting, and then there's what if we didn't exist? Mm-hmm. And I think if you're Coca-Cola, if you're Nike, I mean, you know, Procter & Gamble, I mean, you should be asking these questions. Especially in a global, interconnected, fast-paced, you know, world that we live in.
Right. So, what was the mistake of the year?
Well, we gave it to two individuals. One, but I'll give you one example. And this is a teacher who in lower school who really wanted to look at different writing surfaces, and unbeknownst to us, before the first day of school, she painted half of the desk with chalk paint, and then there were dry erase, you know, surfaces,
right.
And she wanted to kind of test the difference amongst, you know, first graders. And so I saw that there had been some paint spilled on the sidewalk outside. Uh-huh. I'm like, where did this come from? What's going on? I mean, she didn't ask for our our permission to do that.
Right.
But she said, I'm really, I have some questions around writing surfaces in terms of learning spaces for our students. And I would like to take the year to really to understand, you know, the differences and see how students react amongst different writing services and how that contributes, you know, to their learning. And so that was an example of one that now we've renovated the spaces since. And matter of fact, that had an impact on renovating those spaces. So we've actually brought in the K-4 learning studios, we've brought back chalk back to the classroom. Because we want multiple writing surfaces, we want a minimum of four to five different seating options. We want casters on furniture on every piece of furniture, including shelving. And we don't want learning to be one directional. So we don't want a board, a Promethean board or a flat screen or whatever you want on stuck to a wall. We want mobility that you can rearrange it 1,000 times over, and that teachers, that students in particular, even at that age, can not only move the furniture themselves, but are saying we should move it this way to improve our learning. So that
mistake informed all of that, right?
So that mistake in a small way, but it did contribute to it.
Yep.
And so not only do we have these dry erase walls, we have from ceiling to floor, chalk walls as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, and again, you know, the word disruption is kind of interesting. I think that most people that I talk to in leadership really shy away from that. But is it that you are intentionally disruptive in some ways, or do you feel that it's the role of an innovative school to be disruptive in some way?
Well, I like how Grant Ligman talks about, you know, the difference between its, you know, what happened in World War II and in Germany for, you know, the Jewish population. I mean, that change was hard. That mm-hmm. was some things we cannot even fathom. This type of change is really just uncomfortable. This is not catastrophic change that is really that disruptive. But we've been so conditioned on one way to, you know, educate, you know, students for more than 100 years, you know, in this country, that the perception is that it is. Hard, but I think it's more uncomfortable than it is hard. From a disruption standpoint, you know, time is a threat in any school. And so we talk a lot about sort of learning essentials and how do you organize learning? Is it, how prescribed is it? And how student driven, you know, is it? And so when you start messing with, so we're kind of ooching an innovation around in the upper school right now between what would be called disciplinary time and non-disciplinary time. And what does that, you know, look like? You know, part of that disruption was I went before the faculty 3 years ago and I said, we will no longer have department chairs. Those will not exist. And we created a new element called a head of grade because we wanted this focus to be with more of a focus within grade levels. Because we were moving forward related to either not what would be called non-disciplinary or transdisciplinary, you know, sort of work. So it was right. Sort of positioning us for that. So that's disruptive or really the question around what do colleges and universities say? And I always say when we hear that question, what we're saying is what it translates is that we're not shaping the narrative because there are pockets of innovation going on even within college and universities, you know, from University of Southern California and their 4-year interdisciplinary mm-hmm. program, or BAS Connections, you know, at Duke, or I mean, there are just multiple examples, you know, out there. And so I've really tried to demonstrate for our community that this is what the corporate sector is saying about innovation and inquiry and impact. And this is how college universities are addressing this at this moment, even though they're still slow to change. And yet this is how it aligns with what we're doing here at Mount Vernon, and that this is going to position them for later, but it's providing the rich experience now.
Do you think that there's more of an opportunity to do that kind of disruptive work in independent schools than public schools? I mean, what's your sense of that?
Honestly, I'd hate to speculate about that. I think that both sectors have opportunities, you know, and challenges. And I think that from a public school sector, you know, I think part of their challenge is around the prescription for the masses that I think is challenging for educators to differentiate, to customize, to allow some student driven, you know, work that I think is a little bit more of a challenge. But I really talk about how the fact that I don't see a difference between the public and private sector when it comes to innovation. I think we're both guilty of continuing a model that's dead. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, as a matter of fact, I think, you know, even as we speak, you tweeted something from David Perkins. Maybe you could restate that for us, which I think aligns with this very question.
Well, so Dave Perkins from Harvard has a quick little 2.5 minute video. He's the guy who wrote Making Learning Whole, and he says pretty much 90% of what we teach in schools is useless. It's irrelevant, and it doesn't really matter for kids. So
yeah, I like how he stated that. You know, we learn the known instead of the unknown.
That's right.
And and it's through learning the unknown that our children, our students, learn about the known.
That's right.
But we're so focused on we're driving the questions, you know, as adults. And so we're removing all curiosity and the inquisitive nature of humans naturally. We're just sucking the life out of them because it's so driven by adults.
Which circles back to your point about transformation being built on, you know, constantly asking those types of questions, on trying to figure out, you know, what do we do for the unknown? How do we prepare for that unknown piece? It's really pretty interesting.
Well, I think that what I'd add to that is something that we really tried to connect some dots for our community this year that really tie into what you're talking about. Because while it hasn't been perfect, and I don't want to make it sound that here at the school we're perfect in what we're doing, because we're not. But I think that, you know, we begin to talk a lot about, you know, visible thinking, design thinking, performance task, blended learning, you know, the list goes on. And I think that it became that there was a lack of common language even around that, or we were looking at more about the method, and David Perkins talks about that in this short video too, that it became confusing. And I really wanted to try to connect the dots for our community, our teachers, our staff members, as well as our students. And we have developed what we call these, like, what's most essential? If we get anything right as a learning institution, what is it? And so would be familiar to you and familiar to most, but we're saying if we get this right, then we are so far ahead with our students, especially from inquiry, innovation, impact. And just quickly stating them, they're about that relationships are foundational to learning. Not only the relationships between students and teachers, but relationships to external experts. How are we connecting the real world to the school? And I really believe that's a game changer for any public or private school.
Yeah,
and this is not about career day. This is allowing external experts to evaluate and give feedback to our students, or curiosity and passion drive learning. Learning demands interactive and flexible spaces inside the classroom or outside the classroom, where empathy influences learning and learners apply knowledge to make, you know, an impact. Mm-hmm. So we're saying that these are what's most essential for us as a school that aligns with our norms, that aligns with our mission statement, and that is producing, I hate to use that word, but producing what we would call this Mount Vernon mind as students, you know, leave us. Like, and I think that's a good question for most schools in understanding, like what's most essential?
That's right. It's a great question, actually. And it's something that I think, you know, when you have conversations like that, when you ask that question of teachers or leaders, they can answer that question, and they'll answer it pretty much in the ways that you just talked about it. But the difficulty then becomes, again, that there's no culture around those answers. There's no common language around that. There's no vision around that. Everyone knows, I think, I wouldn't say everyone, but most teachers, most people in education would agree what the conditions for powerful learning are. You know, I mean, it's not that hard. The hard part is, though, then making those conditions really happen in classrooms and in cultures. So I want to talk about one really interesting thing that's happened at your school recently, and that is your relationship with the Center for Disease Control around the work you've been doing with design thinking. So maybe give us just a brief overview of your work. I know it's hard to do because you've been doing so much of it, but the work that you're doing in terms of design thinking, in terms of not just helping the people at your school, but you're reaching out now to whole sorts of other schools, having conferences, things like that. But then specifically, the story about how the CDC contacted you and wanted your staff and students to come help them start thinking differently about their work.
So we've been participating or utilizing a mindset of design thinking probably for about a little over 4 years. And I was first introduced to this process or method and mindset at the National Association of Independent Schools. And it was a 1-hour workshop where Kemp Sachs from the Nueva School and a representative from the Stanford Institute for Design leading a 1-hour workshop. And I was so inspired from that 1-hour workshop and knowing the influencers of Dan Pink and others, you know, on our school, that I came back to Mary Cantwell, who's now the director for the Center for Design Thinking, and saying, I think you're kind of doing some of this already. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should try this. We should just ooch it and see what happens. And unbeknownst to me, she began to lead a group of fourth graders through their first design thinking challenge around how might we redesign the classroom. And so from that, the prototypes from it created our first iDesign lab. And so we, you know, schools do it differently and organizations do it differently, but we put it in the hands of students first. So it's not as if we had perfectly shipped this product by saying, we're going to train every single person around design thinking, and then we will introduce it to our students. We had one person that was trained around it, and we then began to put it in the hands of students. And what we didn't know at the time is that this classroom would become this live sort of lab that other people, other teachers, other students could peer in to see what was happening. And that was this brush fire that has taken off in so many ways. So we plopped this this concept where there was the greatest inertia probably at the time. And now way more than 100 design thinking challenges later, our students in K through 12 are utilizing design thinking and are very familiar with the process. More teachers now have been trained. We lead an annual conference around design thinking where people internationally come to this conference to learn more about how to incorporate it. So because of this, I guess, exposure and interaction with people and with different entities, we've now started to be, we're being contacted by corporations, by nonprofits, and even from the civic environment like the CDC to assist them in leading a process of design thinking to help them in what their current in their current work. So one aspect of the CDC, one center within the CDC, contacted the school, and in the beginning there were going to be a few adults that actually were going to be leading this process: Mary Cantwell, Bo Adams, our Chief Learning and Innovation Officer, and Meg Curden, who is the director of our Innovation Diploma. We just launched our first cohort of Innovation Diploma students, and which is fascinating. We can talk about it if you want, but yeah. But the three of them were actually called upon to lead the CDC, but there was sort of a pushback from the three of them to say that these Innovation Diploma students should actually come with us. And they were a bit reluctant, the CDC, about allowing that to happen because they didn't know if this would be effective. And now that it took place, where students were an active part of facilitating this process, we've developed something we call the Flash Lab, and it's a accelerated process for going through the deep design process that that we've developed, and they have commented. By the way, the three issues that they were
I wanted you to talk about these because they were interesting too.
Yeah, I mean, if I have them correct, this is around blood clotting, ADHD, and early pregnancy. So these are three, I mean, weighty, you know, complex issues. And the CDC, as a way to make a dent in these issues, have called upon Mount Vernon and our students and our adults to lead them through it. And they said, you know, we understand that design thinking first started, you know, in the lower school, but what if we were to say that we were able to make a dent into ADHD and blood clotting and early pregnancy because of Mount Vernon Presbyterian School's mindset of design thinking? I mean, that is impactful in a way that students having a rich experience that is real world in ways that they could not have gotten this experience otherwise in a traditional, in the rows, inside the classroom,
right,
prescription way of learning. It just wouldn't be possible. And that's disruptive to, unfortunately, sure, to the current system. By the way, I don't think it takes much to disrupt the current system because it just is how it is.
That's right. So,
one thing I was going to mention that, and it connects to the Innovation Diploma students,
yeah,
is that we've started to, we've kind of gotten into the, you know, one thing that it's emerging is this idea of micro credentialing and badging. And so we're ooching this innovation around badging. And so they were issued their first badging, their first badge with this field experience with the CDC. So instead of building this diploma around 4 years, it would be built more around a set of badges that one has to, the process of going through this. And yet it's not going to look in a traditional way on a transcript, but I mean, you know, we use an extreme example like Jack Andreyka, who's made a dent in pancreatic cancer,
yep,
but he didn't receive any high school credit for making a dent into pancreatic cancer, and that's ridiculous.
Just to be clear, do your kids have different diploma tracks that they can choose into or select into?
Well, we still have that component of advanced placement and honors, and some of those what would be perceived as traditional pathways, you know, for a diploma. And while all of our students are being exposed to and really allowing them to work in a non-disciplinary way in unstructured time, we also wanted to ooch an innovation of allowing a cohort of students who wanted to be a part of something like this and see what took place from it. So they are trailblazers as students, and this is a program that we're really going to see how it's going to evolve, because, you know, there's a lot of work around badging. I mean, that's heavy lifting outside of the whirlwind that's going on, and we're just really trying to make a dent in that because we believe in it, and we feel like that's where students are the most engaged, even around badging versus, you know, traditional metrics of grading.
Do you have a process where kids who are doing great work in informal kinds of learning environments outside of school can get credit for that inside of school?
I wish I could say yes. I think our innovation diploma is going to allow for that more than anything, but it is a question that we're actively talking about because our students, as in every school, are participating and learning well outside the walls of the school, and that should be a part of their portfolio. That's a part of their learning experience. And so I think that schools need to really think about that from a strategic vision standpoint, because that is going to come sooner than later. And speaking of disruption, I think if one is not preparing even in a small way each year, I think when major disruptions that are going to take place amongst college universities as well as in a K-12 setting, it's going to have far greater impact than one is prepared for. So that's an active question that we're trying to address.
I totally agree. And I wonder where you get most of your learning or thinking about what those disruptions might be. I mean, it seems in many cases people aren't really actively thinking about that stuff. They're not really actively looking to the future, trying to figure out, what those disruptions are going to be, or even dealing with the disruptions that are at hand. So how do you as a leader kind of track those things and stay abreast of the conversations that you have to have?
I'm surprised, or I think about how did I learn before, but a flow of learning for me is honestly through Twitter. That has been that part of a professional learning network has had such an impact on not only the research that is being conducted, but also staying abreast of the type of changes around the world. I think another influencer of that outside of social media is the Institute for the Future. And not to say that I prescribe to everything they talk about, but they are trying to understand what might a workforce look like, what are the skills that might be needed, how is the healthcare industry, what does that look like, the flow of learning. They have this great the future of learning as a part of their portfolio, mm-hmm. And I find that to be interesting as a way to understand, what we're doing at the school. So those are a couple of examples. I mean, when you look at the Institute for the Future and you look at the membership of corporations, this is AT&T, Chick-fil-A, and others, because they're trying to understand what is happening around the world and therefore trying to, provide a better product, be more efficient, and so this has an impact on who we are, as schools, I think. And so I think those are a few influencers, for us.
I think that by and large, even at the policy level, we're not spending enough time trying to imagine or reimagine what schools might be like. And I think too much of it is still focused on tweaking around the edges and making schools better. And without that frame, let me end with this last question, because I know that much of your work around design and much of what your kids do around design starts with a prompt, and you used it in our interview, but it's the prompt, "How might we?" And I think it's pretty powerful in terms of getting people to think about the big questions that not only impact their personal lives, but also their education lives, their learning lives. So let me end with this. If you had a couple how might we questions for education in general, for leaders in general, I mean, what would be a couple that you think people should be thinking about and grappling with right now?
So you can tell that from this interview, just being long-winded. And before I get to that, I'd like to really encourage people to read Berger's book, A More Beautiful Question. because I, and that's a recent, that book has been recently, you know, published. And I think if you are building muscles within your students from the earliest ages and begin to build muscles for adults around why, what if, and how, just building muscles around those three questions alone, I think you will make a tremendous impact within the traditional sense of educational communities. But I think you will allow your students to imagine and create and fail and create again in ways that will have a tremendous impact. If it's not now, it's later, by building in the muscles around those three questions and always asking why and what if we did this and how might we do that. So I just to preface the answer around those three questions, that's been so impactful upon me, and I think hopefully impactful, you know, for our community. I think with it, when it comes to, you know, the question that you're asking around how might we, it's such a powerful question because it allows it reflects access. In other words, everyone, where it's collaborative, it's about imagining, you know, the possibility. And you know there are a number of how might we's out there that, you know, how might we redesign the schedule? And that may, I don't know if that is a profound question, but time is a threat. And I mean, who works in life in 45-minute periods? I don't know, but we do that in schools. You know, how might we change the college admissions process? I mean, that is it doesn't seem like a big deal, big question, but I mean, that is monumental. Yeah. Because it's so entrenched into what we're doing. And I think it's really holding students from having authentic learning experiences versus achieving a certain grade, packaging a certain transcript, and trying to get into a university of prestige. And I think there are a number of universities out there that are fearful of the prestige glass being broken or even cracked. Mm-hmm. And I think it's beginning to be cracked, but the Institute for the Future, as an example, if you look at the fine print, you know who is backing the research around Institute for the Future is the University of Phoenix. Mm. And so people, I mean, that's not readily noticed, but they're beginning to break a prestige glass because they're assembling a team of people from what would be considered the, you know, prestige, you know, universities. I mean, I don't know if those sound like big how might we questions, but, you know, how might we obtain, you know, a set of credentials from any university that we would want to have access to? You know, how might we provide experiences for our students where they're driving the process? That may not sound like a big question, but so many times adults are driving the process for students, and unfortunately our students are going to lose out. And yet it would seem abnormal to do it that way when everybody is rowing in the same direction. Right. I don't know if those sound like, you know,
those are great.
I mean, the list
yeah,
goes on.
I know. Well, listen, Brett, I really want to thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. And I'm a big fan of the work you're doing down there. And I'm looking forward to seeing how you continue to disrupt things and extend the conversation out. So appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me, Will. I appreciate your time, too.
Hey, thanks for listening. And don't forget to come back next week for another conversation between Bruce and me about high bar change in schools. If you haven't read our latest white paper on the 8 attributes of modern educational leaders, you can head over to bit.ly/8attpod, and download it. And if you're really getting serious about change in schools and you're a leader who wants to learn how to do that and connect with all sorts of other people from around the world who are doing that, please visit us at change.school, where we're already taking signups for our third cohort that starts in September. So we hope to see you there as well. Have a great week, everyone, and thanks again for listening.